Hello, and welcome once again to the Learning Digital Photography Podcast. This is your host, Jason Anderson, and with me on the show today is none other than David Julian. David, welcome to the show.
Hey, thank you, Jason. Glad to be here.
Glad to have you on. So I brought David on. Well, actually, I think we talked for quite a while about having you come on the show to talk about a number of different things. We have a couple different topics in mind. The first one we wanted to broach was this whole idea of personal projects. And if you look at David's website over at davidjulian.com, one of the very first links on there are personal projects, and he's got some pretty compelling galleries of photos. The first one, Dreams and Visions, is very powerful, I think. Then he also has Taken from the Heart, Flora and Fauna, and Experimental as these different galleries of images. And I thought this would be a great subject to have David come on the show for, to get some insights on a couple different aspects of shooting for personal projects, because you've gone the full gamut. And I know a lot of people, especially including myself, get tied down in a lot of the minutiae and details when it comes to personal projects. So there's kind of five topics I was hoping we could touch on today. The first one is finding that creative voice. It seems like you've been very good at not only identifying for personal projects, but figuring out how you exactly you want to express that voice, or what the voice is you want to express, and then also how to express that. So I was hoping you could start things off just by talking a little bit about your own processes, your own mental thought process as far as finding the creative voice, what's going to inspire you, and then how you determine the best way to share that voice or vision with others.
Okay. Sounds like a great topic to talk about.
Yeah.
I should start off by saying that I have a very checkered past. And what I mean by that is I have a varied background in the things that I've loved to do in my life. I started out in the sciences, actually, as an entomologist. And during that time, I learned to pick up a camera as a recording tool, mostly. Later on, I became a designer and art director in New York City, working on advertising and corporate projects, and still always had the camera with me. I was sort of a hobbyist at that point. And at times, as I hired photographers and illustrators to do various projects under the company title, I became a little bit jealous of their interests, of their interesting creative passions, and had a lot of dialogues with interesting people, and finally decided, you know, I've really got to try this because it's inside me. I really want to know what it's like to commit to this. So, in a sense, the voice found me and really just compelled me.
So, is it like different voices within you that you would say identify different personal projects? Because in looking at your different galleries you have under your personal projects category, they're very different visions. That are expressed here. And just even between the first two, if you look at Dreams and Visions and then do like a comparison contrast between that and Tales from the Heart, one is I don't want to say dark, but I guess much darker than others. And a lot of it has religious tones. And then you move from that into the flora and fauna, which is nowhere near as religious.
Not at all.
The overtones. So I'm just wondering, what is it about different things that inspire you? I mean, I guess it sounds like religion plays a part of it for you. Is that a fair assessment?
It's actually not. It's an interesting thing. I often question how it is I ended up becoming so fascinated with crosses as parts of images. But really what happened is, and this is a bit of an aside from the topic, but what happened is as I traveled, and being who I am, I'm always attracted to decrepit buildings, things that misused land, old, run-down places, as many of us are. They're just full of texture and wonder. I found myself photographing a lot of graveyards, a lot of cathedrals, and because my background, actually, I'm from a Jewish family who was raised without very much intensity of that religion and had a lot of Catholicism around me, I think I just became fascinated with the cross as a powerful archetype symbol. And the places that are adorned with or that feature crosses tend to be pretty intense places energetically.
Wow.
Yeah. So I pick up on how I feel around those places, and the energy of that feeds my photographic eye.
Interesting. Okay. That, wow, that's... So when you get that energy or that vibe from a particular venue, that clearly is identifying things for you from a visual perspective. Wow, the lighting behind that one cross has such amazing shadows, and oh my God, I love how the shadow's being cast, and I love the color tones of that red coming through the window, that sort of thing. In identifying that sort of vision that you have, how do you determine what the best way is to share that vision? Like, I know so many photographers that will just throw together slideshows and then put them in Vimeo and throw some kind of musical score on there and say, okay, that's my vision.
Yeah.
And your vision is very different from that, because I noticed none of these have audio overlays, at least not that I'm seeing by default.
No, I haven't actually developed that portion of the website. It's a fairly new site, and I'm just now populating it with galleries. So it is,
oh, okay.
It does, in a sense, not truly reflect my intention here, but let's just say that the photographs speak what I'm about. So back to what you said, how do I decide to create something in a place that I'm in?
Okay.
What happens is I found over time, as many creative people do, that they're sensitive to environmental things. They're sensitive to light, sensitive to sound. I'm extremely sensitive to light and sound, almost sometimes overwhelmingly. So I listen very easily to what happens to me when I'm in a place. How do I feel? When I walked into my first cathedral in Europe, I was blown away, not from a religious standpoint.
Interesting.
Purely from the power of the depth of the building, the innate qualities of it, the colors that are used inside, the warm colors toward the pulpit or the cool colors toward the entrance, where it literally almost brings you into a holy space. And
sure.
Without thinking too much about the past and meaning of all of it, I just reacted to how I felt. And that really guides my eye more than seeing graphics, seeing light, or seeing patterns, and just simply capturing that and calling it a day. I literally sit there without a camera for a while. A little bit more of a meditative approach than some, and not suitable for my journalistic experiences where I'm really on the go. But when I have the time to sink into a place, I really do. And
so how long do you – I'm sorry, go ahead.
No, you go ahead, Jason.
Well, I was just going to ask, well, it's really interesting that you take this meditative approach and you really sink in. And I think a lot of times photographers, and I'm just as guilty as others, especially in this run-and-gun day and age of technology and, you know, got to get here, got to get there. I mean, David can even attest to this. I was running late coming up to this podcast. And, you know, we get in this hurry-up, rush mentality. And a lot about, I think, having a creative vision anyway is recognizing the need to slow down and be more meditative, because that's really when creative visions can really become powerful enough for someone to really have a cohesive thought and take everything in, like you said, from the light and the colors and the tones and the moods and figuring out the best way to express that.
Yeah, I think that's accurate for me. In my workshops that I teach around the country, I meet a lot of people from different social classes, from different backgrounds, different age groups.
And hey, David.
Yeah.
I'm actually getting a little bit of noise or wind interference there.
Okay.
Is your mic could you put your mic a little closer to your mouth there so it'll pick up better?
Is that a little bit better, Jason?
Yes, that's much better. So I'm sorry. Go ahead. You were saying?
Yeah. If need be, I'll move indoors. So in the workshops that I teach, I take people to places, and we emphasize the awareness of the place before the shooting of the place. The reason is that I think that you can do a run and gun, and you can react as a photographer with a very versatile tool in your hands before actually knowing what it is you're shooting, before having any relationship with it.
Ooh, I like that.
Yeah, it's you know, it's a different approach. Obviously, if you're shooting a wedding or you're doing photojournalistic work or street photography, your awareness and your senses are very busy doing other things.
Yeah.
But
yeah, I don't know many wedding photographers that are meditative in their approach.
No, not likely. But if you get used to what you do, no matter what it is you do, you can start to feel those vibes beneath the excitement and beneath the visuals that are happening in front of you,
right.
Which is how those personal projects came about. The personal project come about because of a photograph I take, not because I say, you know, I'm going to go out and do a photographic project about this. It's the other way around. Something happens, and I think, wow, I want this to happen again and again and again, and it would make a great project.
Huh. Do you think are you also saying that it, because it does happen that one way, that it's not a two-way street? So.
It is definitely a two-way street. The project I'm about to work on now that I've just begun was conceptualized before it was visualized.
Awesome.
Still actually trying to work out how I want the images to look because it's a complete departure from my existing work. I'll just take a second to talk about that.
Sure, that'd be great.
The project in question is called Cherished Things. And what happened is after I shot Taken from the Heart in New Orleans in 2005 after Katrina, I came home and my world was upside down. I mean, I had just been in a place where people had lost almost everything they had. What they owned was strewn around the landscape, sometimes yards, sometimes over a mile from where they lived. Mm-hmm. And I thought, what is it that I own here in my house? What would I do if the helicopter hovered above and said, get up the ladder now? What would I grab? What material thing would I take with me? Because we all have something we care about. Well, what happened is I identified what that was for me, and I thought, the dialogue I have between myself and this object is an interesting one. What if I went around taking portraits of people and their most cherished object and then recorded the story about that?
Very cool.
So that's what Cherished Things is about. And as you can see, one thing led to another, and there I am.
Do you think, I think a lot, for me anyway, that's usually how, I say usually, but that's more often than not how a creative vision comes to fruition, at least internally. You know, I think that internalized vision for something probably always exists, and we're always, you know, whether we're struggling with creative thoughts and projects or whether they're coming to us in million miles at a, you know, mm-hmm. a million at a time, especially if you're in the creative field, you tend to be more aware and I guess acute of everything that's coming at you from all these angles, whether it's audible or visual or conceptually, different things that go on around you. And every once in a while, if something rings true or, mm-hmm. you know, just resonates with you, and that's usually the genesis, if you will, yep. of personal projects. You know, it's just something happens from inside, and you can't really force it to happen because it's either going to happen or it's not.
Yeah, that's very well put, and sometimes you can't get it out of your mind.
Right.
I'm just as much attracted to rusting automobiles as the next guy I know with a camera. But I know that something turns me on about them that's a little more than just the visual of something that's rotting into the ground or rusting. It's something about history. It's something about the fact that someone once owned that and had fun with it and loved it. And so I try to read a little more deeply into the things I'm attracted to and think about what is going on inside me.
Right. You look at it, it sounds like you're looking at it not just from a personal project perspective, but also from an emotional level, and you're trying to bring that emotion to the core or to the fore as well.
Yeah. Yeah, I think that growing up with three sisters, a mom and an aunt, really taught me a little bit about intuition. and
women have that effect on us, yes.
Yeah, and I love it. I love the fact that I learned so much from my female friends and my girlfriend and whatever. I learn a lot about how they feel and think, and it informs my artistic work. Because
right.
you know, artists and creative people tend to be sensitive to input, like I said before, and some of us are also attention deficit, so our minds are going a mile a minute, and that's how we creatively think. We put
right.
things together that others may pass by.
Right.
And loaded with photography equipment that we know how to use, very well, we are more free to just feel and be aware of what's going on around us rather than concentrating on the dials, buttons, the viewfinder.
Well, that kind of brings up an interesting question, because you talk about, you know, the cameras that we know and the dials and the buttons that we know, and knowing, and we're focusing more on the creative concepts.
Mm-hmm.
I think you hit on something kind of important there, because I have known people that will pick up a camera and they'll be like, God, I have this creative vision. I know what my vision is. I just don't know how to get it out. I think oftentimes there's a technical, especially in today's day and age, or I'm sorry, not in today's day and age, less so in today's day and age, but especially with the early generations of SLR photography where things were still very complex,
yep.
That there was quite a technical barrier to understanding that. But having a better understanding of what I would call the fundamentals is what really enables you to become more creative. That if you're fixated on, well, geez, what's my f-stop supposed to be? What's my ISO supposed to be? What's my aperture supposed to be? What focal length is perfect exposure? What's the circle of confusion supposed to be? You get wrapped up in all that, and you have no creative vision. It's not there yet because you're still wrapped up in the fundamentals.
Yeah.
And it's only when you've got that so down that it's like migrate. I think Joe McNally said that sundry stuff migrates to the back of your mind,
mm-hmm.
and that lets the camera become kind of an extension of you.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
More.
I agree with that. And yes, also I had a dialogue with Joe about that too, and many others. Sam Abel. I mean, lots of people, you know, luckily we get a chance to cross-reference each other. And very true. Back when I learned photography using film cameras, you really did have to know how that camera worked, and you had to know how to control it in order to get anything out of it that was pleasing. Now... And now the cameras have so many incredible, smart, automatic, and technically proficient features. We've been allowed to take a step back from that knowledge. However, it quickly becomes obvious whether the camera's taking the picture, or the camera's making decisions, or whether the artist is. And so in the workshops that we talk about intuition and awareness and all of these other things that lead to the creative portion, of course the technical things are addressed so that we can really nail those down. As Joe McNally said, and as you paraphrased, put it to the back of your mind and concentrate on what you feel.
Hey, Joe, I just said Joe. Hey, David, I'm getting a little more wind there.
Right,
I'm not sure if it's getting windier there or not, but yeah, putting it to the back of your mind or making it sundry stuff, I think that's a point that's well driven home. When it comes to personal projects and bringing that kind of vision to life. So I guess the next part of this whole creative process of defining personal projects and finding that creative voice, the next part of that would be determining the best way to share that vision. Because I know some people, a lot of people actually are talking these days about this convergence of still photography and videography. And, you know, some people are saying, well, what's the difference between a time-lapse photo series and a video? You know, and asking all these technical questions. And, again, it brings back in the technical, but it's also bringing in this other aspect of determining what the best way is to share that vision. Is that vision something that needs to be shared through still images where it's a particular moment in time that you want to capture the essence of? Or is it a particular series of moments in time that collectively come together to mean something for you? And then, you know, if so, which one do you use and how you define or determine what the best way is to share whatever that vision is that you have identified internally, and then how to bring that from the internal to the external.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So I guess I would probably throw it back to you at this point to see what your thoughts are on making that internal vision an external one. What decides for you how... your f-stops are set, well, I shouldn't say your f-stops, but whether or not it's a darker image or a lighter image, and how the composition goes, you know, what drives that portion of it for you?
Okay, well, that's plenty of information. Let me break that down.
I asked loaded questions. I probably should have forewarned you about that.
That's okay, because I give run-on long answers, so we're perfectly matched for this. Okay. All right, starting with a capital letter and ending with a long period some other time. I experiment a lot. It's pretty evident from my website that I don't have a specific style or a single style that I market and that I'm known for. I treat I treat the medium of photography and photo illustration as a place that I can experiment freely in. When everything goes well, things just happen in a way that I may or may not predict, but that work perfectly. I just know it when something's right. We all do that. We all have that knowledge that we just shot an amazing photograph, or that we just shot some mediocre ones and we're going to move on. So to bring it to fruition, I make photographs pretty freely when I'm traveling. Just like everybody else, I've got lots of duds that I edit out quickly in Lightroom, usually as soon as I can, so I can keep my knowledge fresh as to what worked and what didn't work. I process images freely, crossing between black and white and color. And when I see an image come up on my screen that I've just shot, and it doesn't quite say what I want, that's when I have a chance to do some further work on the image to tweak it towards what I really envisioned when I was standing there, or what I imagined it could be like. Because let's face it, our world is in color for most of us. It's moving in real time, and our eyes are not apertures and diaphragms.
Right.
We can't freeze the moment that well. I mean, we can have a momentary recollection, especially a powerful one, or we can blink and have a blink moment. But when we face these images that we've shot, we have a chance to just sit back, look at it, look at the composition, and go, is this what I wanted it to say? So I'm constantly in that fluid dialogue of, is this what I want it to say?
Huh.
When it comes to taking images from, let's say, the Taken from the Heart series, which are straight photo documentary images, they're not touched, they're not messed around with, there's no Photoshop. The thing that I wanted from that was a true recording of what I saw.
Right.
The way I attempted to get that. Yeah, it is. And the other thing is, I wanted the images to convey the feeling of being there and zeroing in and taking them. I did intimate portraits of lost objects, and I wanted people to identify with what that was.
Right.
So those images could be in color. They could be basically stills from a tour around the area, whereas other images have to have a lot more story in them. And that may be a different kind of composition. You'll notice there's a lot of symmetry in my work. I go for very strong symmetrical images a lot, which may or may not be the customary rule of thirds or golden section or some of the things that are that are really drilled into photographers through the media and through instruction. But I find that there's a lot of power in a symmetrical image. So when I want a powerful image, I often go for a symmetrical composition. And so I shoot that way, and I also crop that way.
Interesting. So that kind of ties into something you said just a minute ago too, where you were talking about almost getting there in camera, but something's slightly different that you remember from the moment that isn't exactly expressed in the initial raw image. And I'm assuming you shoot in raw.
Yeah.
It sounds like you do anyway. So then you take that raw image, and then it sounds like you're doing just a little bit of minor tweaking or adjusting, massaging it just a little bit to express that creative image through your post-production. And you mentioned Lightroom. We can talk about the technical there too.
Mm-hmm.
But I think the important takeaway here is that when you're approaching things from a journalistic perspective, a lot of people think, oh, it's photojournalism. You can't edit. You can't retouch. If you're reporting for a newspaper, that's probably true.
Mm-hmm.
But if you're doing a photojournalistic style for a personal project, that doesn't mean you can't edit in post-production. You can take a color image and make it black and white. You can blur the edges to help bring in focus. You can adjust your exposure values if you want it to be a more darker. That's good English.
Yeah.
If you want it to be a more darker image, you can adjust the exposure values in your slider settings.
Yep.
It's okay to do that. It's that photojournalism doesn't necessarily mean you can't edit in post-production. You can. It just depends on the nature of the project. And that was just a great point that you brought up that I kind of wanted to reiterate. Let's bring it a little bit back home to roost so we can help the the new coming artists, because a lot of beginning photographers tune into the podcast. So to start off, you have to identify, you know, what the vision is or what what visual cues are compelling to you from a particular moment or scene, and then it's capturing that. And like you said, when you know you've caught an image, you've caught it. So the next step is to take it into Lightroom or take it into Elements or take it into Photoshop and see if that image is what you remembered. And if it is, great, you're done. And then share it with the world. And if it's not quite there, you know, then you figure out that it goes back to the technical. It's kind of a back and forth, you know, between the technical and the creative to try and massage things to get them to where you want them to be. So it's this never-ending flow that always kind of happens when you're going through your personal project progression there.
Yeah, I get a lot of questions from students. How do you know when you're done? And they're usually asking this about my more composited and very densely layered images. How do I know when I'm done? I'm done.
Well, that
when
was going to be my next question. Yeah, so, yeah.
I'm done when I've told the truth. I'm done when I have accurately responded to and recorded or turned a piece into something I wanted it. So what that can mean is I can take a photograph, let's say, of for lack of another idea, I could take a photograph of a beautiful building, such as an old cathedral. I would photograph that from several positions to get different moods out of it. It can be part of a larger landscape as a highlight to it. It can be full on dead center in the image, looking up at it as if it's a hero image, right? So objects that are done symmetrically in the center of your image, especially from a low angle looking up, it's a very hero proportion.
Like right. Looking it's almost up. Like larger than life kind of thing.
Exactly, looming above you. And so right. If you look at photographs from that point of view, you get different feedback internally from what you're seeing. A lot of people don't notice that. They know that they're attracted to certain kinds of pictures, but they don't think about why. I spend a lot of time thinking about what is it about this image? Do I feel empowered or do I feel belittled by this building? So I try to take lots of different versions or compositions, and then I look at them as I'm editing and say, which one stands out as the one that really speaks to me about this place or this building or that experience?
Right, and that actually, that's what you're like doing a perfect segue into a post that I did just recently. And from the date that we're recording the podcast, which is Tuesday the 28th, if you go back to my blog post from the 27th, this speaks exactly to what David was just talking about. My blog post from yesterday talked about looking at something, anything, whether it's a lamp that inspires you or a cathedral or a leaf or a flower or whatever. Whatever it is you're looking at, try and look at that object that's inspiring you or that color or that tone or whatever it is and try and take that image from 13 different views. And I just picked the number 13 as a random number. And in doing that, my guarantee or my promise was that hopefully you will find at least one that creates that compelling image that you wanted to share with the world. And like you said, whether it's that cathedral, you know, empowers you or makes you feel tiny or, you know, gives you an energy that you couldn't express before or just you stand in awe of because of its impact in the entire environment. Like you said, if it's a symmetrical cathedral and how it's positioned inside the larger arena of a particular landscape, that can be part of that expression. Swathed in the beauty of the fading light of the day or, you know, whatever the theme happens to be for that particular image, when you do that or when you venture into those new angles and different angles, finding the angle that you saw with your eye, it's an interesting creative process to take what you saw with your eye and capture it with your camera, because what you see with your eye is so different from what the camera sees, which is why kind of that sundry stuff is so important to go low, go high, shoot at things from different angles. Try popping a fill flash with the sunset in the background, because your eyes see so much more when it comes to the width and the depth of field and the dynamic range and to get that all inside the camera takes so many different iterations, and there's so many possibilities out there that if you are exploring a creative vision, the best way to explore that vision is to just keep shooting from different angles. And you do kind of, like, again, it goes back to the sundry stuff. You have to know the details to try and get what it is you're looking at, and then trying that same technique from different angles or trying different techniques rather than just spraying and praying. You know, so you don't. In other words, you don't set it at f8 1/60th of a second in ISO 800 and do that same setting all over the place.
Mm-hmm.
Because that's not going to accomplish anything but give the same depth of field, just different angles. And while the different angles are good, try popping a different shutter speed in there. Try dropping your ISO or bringing your aperture settings down and creating a wide bokeh there. So things are nice and smooth, and pop a flash after the sun's gone down. That's a great little trick. Popping a flash when the sun goes down. Try that with portraiture. That's fun stuff, and it can create some amazingly compelling images. Just even if you're just exploring something, it doesn't necessarily have to be a personal project that gets completed. I don't think there's anything inherently wrong with exploring a project that doesn't get finished, but it does help when you have a personal project that you want to accomplish to have that beginning, middle, and end time to determine whether or not you're finished and to know when you are finished. So, yeah, that's definitely something to consider. The next step in the process, then, would be this whole concept that we started talking about when we were talking about taking our images into Photoshop or Lightroom or Elements or Aperture or whatever software you happen to be using, because now we're starting to talk about capture time. And we're looking at the amount of time we're out in the field taking pictures, and okay, I probably have enough pictures to bring this project to fruition. So then the question is, well, how much time should I spend in post-production? You know, is it worth trying to do an HDR pano of 250 images? To express one creative vision. And I know some people, I'm still in search of that perfect pano image that I can do that with, and I still haven't found it. So it's this one personal project that's just always been eluding me internally, just finding the right scene that encompasses all of those features. So I guess that would be the next part of the next phase of this whole process that I'd throw over to David to talk about, is talking about capture time versus post-production time. Is there a ratio there that you find works for you? And if so, what is that?
Okay, well, it goes back to what you said about spray and pray or run and gun. Clearly, and I was at a wedding recently in Atlanta, and a fellow there was, one of the guests actually in the family, he had his camera on the fastest of its multi-frame speeds. Okay, this was a D700, and that thing was firing a lot of images. And I said, "What are you doing?" I said, "You're going to spend the rest of your life editing." And he said, "Yeah, well, I'm not sure what I'm doing, so I know that if I take this many frames, I will definitely get what I want." And I thought about that for a second and thought, okay, well, there's some legitimacy to that. But for me, I don't want to spend that much time editing the ones that didn't work, because it does take time, and it takes away from the value of the rest of my time. So I tend to actually treat the digital camera a little more closely to the way I treated a film camera. It's not about card size. It's not about not taking advantage of the speed of digital or the ability to edit. It's because I want my total experience to still be creative, and the time I spend rejecting images isn't creative time for me. It may be a good learning experience to see how I was so deeply attracted to this one thing and shot the heck out of it, and gee, I don't like any of these images. That's instructive, and that's very good, you know, personal self-feedback.
Sure. Very therapeutic, too.
Yeah, it can be. But
yeah, I didn't do anything, but hey, I was out shooting all day.
Yeah, well, you know, but it's okay because you had an experience. That's fine. It's absolutely legitimate. My keep ratio is probably 4% or 5% because okay. I'm a ruthless editor. Do I keep a lot of things I don't think I'll ever do anything with? Absolutely. What do I do with those? Well, a lot of those go into image database files that I have for use in other purposes, backgrounds, to use in instruction. You know, why did I switch from F1.4 to F16 in the same place? And it's going back to what you said. Why stick with one formula in your camera when your mind and your eye are changing the game 24/7. So right. Yeah, shoot different ways as you shoot something, rather than just moving from here to there and just getting your body in different positions. And yes, bend down. I mean, I'm famous for scraping ants and grass off my back, because I'm on my back a lot when I shoot. Believe it or not, I get down very, very low and use wide angles and look up at things. And even though I get the converging lines that a lot of people try not to get, I want the dynamic and I want the experience of being fully involved.
I personally love converging lines. If you look at a lot of the architecture type work that I've done in the past, those converging lines of that building where it's pointing up and one side is going to my far right and the other side is my far left, and it just looks huge, and people are like, you have converging lines, what are you doing? It's coming down. I'm like, I know, look how powerful that is. Isn't that awesome? Mm-hmm. And people are like, but they aren't straight. I'm like, oh, jeez.
Well,
horizontal doesn't make the world go round. The world is a circle. There is no horizontal in the world.
Well, but you know what's funny about that? And you know, I'll do a quick aside from that. We grow up with the rectangle, right? It's in right. everything. It's in our paper. It's in our computer screens, our televisions, whatever it is we have. We sit at a square table, most of us. Our cabinets are square. We live in a world of man-made straight lines. Hmm. The only other place in nature that those straight lines exist are in crystals or in light waves. I mean, let's think about that. So if we are so embroiled in the world of right angles, it's natural that we also start to try to break that mold. And my students and I work pretty heavily on breaking the mold of what's expected. Our viewfinders are rectangles. Our LCD preview screens are generally rectangles. Well, once I'm in Photoshop, I make a canvas that's very large, and I put the image dead center in this big white space. So I have freedom to go outside the lines like a kid with a coloring book.
That's awesome. Now, see, you've given me two possible titles for the podcast. I don't know if I should call the podcast Crystals and Light Waves or Draw Outside the Lines. I think both are equally cool titles. So we'll see which one comes up when we go and produce the show. But that's very – I like what that point is you just made about we live in a world of rectangles, and that's not natural. It's not nature, because I think, and this is kind of an interesting aside here, just talking about personal projects and where your creative mind takes you. I think the world is always trending towards a cacophony of things where, you know, you see a line go this way and then that way, and then it curves and then it goes a little bit straight and then it curves again and then it goes off to the right and then off to the left. I think the world I'm looking for is chaos here. The world trends towards chaos, and we try and make order out of chaos, and while that's kind of necessary for society,
yeah.
from a creative point of view, that chaos is actually something worth embracing. There's nothing wrong with embracing the chaos from a creative perspective.
Yet, we also want to organize things, and we need boundaries.
Right.
Everyone needs a bit of a boundary, right? We would just be flinging each other into space if we didn't have any boundaries, right?
Oh,
so all of this is good. It's all good. You know, we have a frame with which we compose in. That's great. We can also crop later and recompose the image so it has more punch, and we may have several versions of that. One of the things I love about Lightroom and Adobe Camera Raw is that we can do virtual cropping and tilting and all kinds of things that give us a chance to explore creatively without changing the actual file.
We're just in a love fest here. Yeah, that's great. That's awesome. Let's get back to the crux of that question that we were talking about, post-production time versus capture time. It sounds like you are both on the same side of the fence where we'd rather spend more time shooting and less time in post-production. Do you have general rules of thumb, like, okay, if I spend more than 10 minutes trying to edit an image, I'm done?
I wish I did.
Well, I know some people that set timers. I know a couple of photographers that they'll have a little timer, and they say, okay, if I spend more than 2 minutes editing an image, I delete it. I'm like,
wow,
really?
Wow,
that's hardcore.
That's just hardcore. When I'm under deadline, I definitely have a sort of a limitation on to what I will do. But my very nature is to explore. I'm really first and foremost an explorer. I just happen to carry a camera a lot. And in order to explore fully, I cannot place limitations unless I have hardcore deadlines, and which I always meet. but I don't want to place limitations. I'm a bit of a rebel that way. I am not as disciplined in time use as I could be, but I also really believe in what happens when I let myself flow. And,
sure.
Yeah, sometimes I have to throw the other voice out that says, all right, listen, you've spent, you know, 2.5 hours on this. Is it something you're really going to keep? No, but I really wanted to see how this panorama would look if I HDR'd every single frame of it.
God.
And I did that recently, too. I found myself worked really hard on a piece. That, yeah. And I thought, what am I doing? Well, oh, yeah, that's what I'm doing. Oh, yeah, that's what I'm doing.
Oh, yeah. It's like you got to remind the whole sometimes.
Yeah, the digital machine. Anyway, yeah, the digital time machine is being able to keep going and going. Most people say, "What? How do you know when you're done?" Well, I know when the power goes out that I'm pretty much done with that image.
That's it for me. I know when I'm done. When it's 4 o'clock in the morning, and my wife wakes up from after having been asleep for 6 hours and says, "Aren't you done yet?" I'm like, "What are you talking about? It's only 11:30," and she's like, "No, it's not." And I look at my clock, and I'm like, oh, crap, I got to go to work in the morning.
We've all done it.
Yeah, we can definitely get lost in the moment. I think it's kind of, for the emerging crowd of photographers in the audience there, I think the real answer to that question is there is no real hardcore answer. You can't say it's a 2-to-1 ratio or a 1-to-2 ratio or 1-to-1 or 4-to-3. You know, there's no hard, fast set rule for how much time you spend in capture mode versus post-production mode. It's what works best for you. How much do you want to explore something before you think you've exhausted all possible avenues of expression? It's a pick and choose your battles kind of thing. You know, do you want to go out and try and reshoot something? So many times I've seen a photo come through my camera, and I'm like, hey, I really like that. That looks good. That has potential. And then I'll go and I'll spend 10 minutes in that, and I'll be like, yeah, okay, that works. You know, let's see what some people think of it. So I'll share it with a friend or a family member or post it up in one of these forum communities or something like that. And someone will be like, well, maybe you should go back and reshoot it. I'm like, but I spent 10 minutes in post-production on this. What do you mean go back and reshoot it? They're like, well, it looked like you got this right. You didn't, you know. And that brings up the whole question of what is right. You know, is it right for you or is it right for someone else? Why do you have this, you know, this creative expression of photography? Are you doing it to please yourself or to please others? You know, these are all hardcore internalizing questions that you can only answer for yourself. We can't answer them for you.
Well, you just said something really important. Are you there to please yourself or to please others? If you're only concerned about what your friends will think about your photos when you show them, then you're trying to represent something rather than be something. And what I mean by that is it's very compelling for us to want to share our images. That's part of our communication, and it's part of the joy of photography, is sharing your vision or your expertise or your learning. But one of the things to listen to when you're working so hard on an image and you realize you've got another 200 to go is this image done, meaning have I done enough to say what it is I need to say? And can I copy the settings or create a preset so that I can repeat this brilliant rendition across a variety of images? And that's the difference between the ratio idea, because I think that experimenting freely and blowing time is a good thing if you feel like you're doing something constructive.
Or productive.
And if you're doing something that you think that, yeah, productive, constructive, production. If you feel like you're really getting somewhere and you're learning something, it's time well spent. If you can create an automating preset or in some way repeat that success, then you're really off to something.
Right.
It's
funny,
it's possible with a lot of the digital tools that we're talking about.
Right. And it's funny that, because I know a bunch of photographers that will talk about a good photographer versus an emerging photographer or a professional photographer, and they'll talk about repeatable results. You know, can you get the same thing? You know, was it dumb luck? Like, the joke I'll always say when someone says, hey, Jason, that was a really good picture you took. I'm so glad you, like, I was just talking offline with David before we started this, because he lived in Seattle and I was just in Portland, and I was over in Astoria and took some pictures of the Peter Iredale, this wreck up on the coast there. Those were the subjects of yesterday's post. And some of those images just spoke so truly to me. I just, oh my gosh, I have to share these. So that's what that little project, that's what came from that little project that went live yesterday. And just the whole process of that was people saying, well, wow, this is one of the best ones I've seen from you, you know, this kind of thing, that kind of thing. And while that's all well and good, if someone was to come out and say, well, I don't like the lighting here, or, gee, that's kind of harsh orange in that there, and it's okay. Not everyone has to love your work. You know, don't be afraid of naysayers. And it took me all of 5 minutes to go through these 13 different images, and then I was able to, I knew what my settings were, and I could repeat them. And I was happy with what those settings were, so regardless of what angle I'm shooting from, I know that I've got my camera dialed in where I want it to express the vision that I want, so then I just get more creative with the angle of view, popping a flash here and there, trying different things, and that's really the best way to approach personal projects. You know, finding settings that work for you, repeating those settings so you can reproduce those settings any given time if you want to get that same impact in another environment. You know what to do. That's part of that whole learning curve, I think.
Or at least you know where to start.
Right, or at least you know where to start. Right. Exactly. So I guess the last portion of this show was to talk. We've already talked about how do you know when you're done, so completing a project. how do you know when you're done? Capture with your capture time, and how you know when you're done with your production time. But is the project really and here's the ultimate question. This is very esoteric, so for those of you that may be more into the nitty-gritty hardcore shutter aperture kind of stuff, the esoteric question I'm about to ask is the project done because you finished with your post-production, or because you've shared that project or delivered that project to whomever is supposed to be the recipient? Is it article for a magazine? Is it your viewing audience? Is it a personal project that you just need to get out of you? So once it's out of you, is it done? Or do you need to share that through some venue or some medium? And then what ties into that is, how do you share that? Do you promote it? Do you market? Do you advertise it? You know, all these kinds of things that, even though we don't usually talk about them to a great degree, I think it's an important aspect of it that a lot of people don't really consider. They think, okay, I've done my capture, and I've done my post-production, and I've uploaded to the web, and it's on this website, so it's done. Is it? How is it done if nobody's to the web, but if no one sees it, is it done? And I guess the point I'm trying to
That sounds a little bit like the tree falling in the forest.
Right, exactly. You fall in the forest and no one's around, does it make a noise kind of thing? So just because you've captured and you've done your post-production, you've posted to the web, doesn't mean you're done necessarily, because, and here's where I kind of say, you know, don't be afraid of bragging, if you know, for lack of a better phrase. You have to hey, I've just finished this personal project. Look at these pictures of a shipwreck that I just took up on Astoria, Oregon. Look at these pictures that I took from a trip where I was down in New Orleans. Look at this portfolio of images. It really spoke to me. I'd like to share it with you. If you don't tell people about it, they're not going to come to your website. Right? They're not your Flickr page or your WordPress blog or anything like that, unless you tell them about it. Because not everyone is always going and hitting your website. Trust me. I've seen the stats on my website. Not everyone is always going there. I've been going to places, so I guess that kind of let's take the question back over and get David's take on this thing of bringing it to fruition and completion. You know, what kinds of things do you do to say this project has been completed? I have my start point, I have my middle point, I have my end point. David, I'll turn it to you, and maybe you can answer some of these questions of where your endpoint is and how you go through this whole process of promotion and advertising and marketing and broadcasting message to the world.
All right. How many hours do you have? Well, the shorter answer to that is, and I also want to just do a little sound check here. Your voice is going in and out. If mine is steady, then we're good to go. So just let me know. There are several answers to that, really. And in my experience, some of my projects have beginning, midpoint, and finite endpoints. It's because I have an idea. I have mapped out how I'm going to approach the photography and the production end of it, and then I complete my self assignment or my project or my client assignment because I've set a deadline and I have the images I need for that. That's one way, and that's a fairly finite logistical approach. But what normally happens for me is I start to see something happening in a place and I want to record it. And I come back over and over again, and the project evolves rather than is a finite idea. And I think that's more of what people who probably are listening to this podcast do, where you get intrigued by something or you're traveling, and the finite endpoint of your project is when you get back on the plane and you come home, for many people. But the other way of approaching it is, have you said what you need to say? Is it time to wrap this up rather than try to perfect the minute bits of it until you're almost tired of it? And I agree with what you're saying, Jason. It's good to share things in process, not just when you think you're done. I think that's a really, really important thing, is to bring others into your process, because if you find that you're motivated by acceptance and acknowledgement from others, you might find that that keeps you from knowing what you're about in the image or knowing when your project's done.
Right.
Involving people partway around, or even interactive with a client, for instance, or collaborating, is a great way of getting a little bit of feedback and telling yourself where it's going and giving yourself a little more information. So camera clubs, personal groups, like I did one called the Cranial Crowbar for 7 years. I assembled 6 photographers, and we got together monthly, had a little wine and beer and some cheese or whatever, and we talked about what we were doing, not who we were working for, but what we were doing for ourselves, what we were doing artistically or experimentally, whether it's books, films we'd read, anything that we could do to create a dialogue around each other's creative process. And that was awesome.
That is awesome. I think that's a lot of what I kind of enjoy about photography as well, is some of the interactions that can happen from that. So like you said, with these like photo clubs, there was one in Denver, a couple in Denver actually, called the meetup groups. And these meetup groups are fantastic ways of not only expressing your ideas and sharing your thoughts and concepts with others, you know, works in progress or WIPs, like I call them, you know, sharing those WIPs with others, hearing what WIPs other people have. You know, what are other people's creative ideas?
Yeah.
And it's also a great way to just to network, because when you have a creative bug inside of you, sharing that doesn't necessarily have to be photographic. You know, having these networks.
Exactly.
These
brilliantly said. Brilliantly said.
It's so powerful and engaging to do that kind of thing. And so it's definitely something to help you stay engaged not only in your own projects, but it also can help be a motivator. Because if you share a personal project with someone else that you're working on, some kind of WIP with someone else, and you say, hey, I've got this project I'm working on, if they're real friends and real motivators, they'll come back to you in a couple weeks and say, hey, how's that project going? Are you done? I can't wait to see it when it's done. And that kind of, it keeps you on task if sometimes you get distracted with these ADD things like we all are prone to these days. So that's good to network with others. I think that was an awesome point you made about photo clubs and networking and sharing with people at various stages of the process, because let's face it, no one is an island. You know, you can't be completely isolated all the time. You have to have those interactions and those engaging discussions with others. So, yeah, I think that's definitely a great point that you made there, Dave. That's awesome.
Well, meetups are fantastic. I'm glad you brought that up.
I'm sorry, go ahead. What were you saying?
I was going to say meetup.com is a great resource for localized photography meetups, photography groups. It's free, and most of the time people get together and trade ideas. When people say they're afraid to show their work, it's not done yet, or it's not ready yet, or it's not good enough, when you feel that happening, that's when you should be showing it the most. And that happens so often. I hear that so often. And I have that inner dialogue sometimes, too, when I've really been working hard, and I'm like, God, this isn't quite there yet. That prevents me from really opening up and sharing what I'm doing and perhaps finding a different perspective. So I just wanted to say that to your audience. It's everyone has that feeling that their stuff isn't either good enough or that particular photo isn't ready, or just forget about that. You know, you've heard the feel the fear and do it anyway. Well,
right.
How about feel the fear and show it anyway? Show
wow.
it anyway.
Feel the fear. Oh, another possible title. Feel the fear and show it anyway. That's awesome.
Good.
And
okay.
What? Oh, ask Joe McNally, because for those of you that don't know, there's a Google Talk out there where Joe McNally is out visiting the folks at Google, and he does this hour-long talk, and I've watched that over and over, and there's so many things I take away from that each and every time. And one that's always, you know, a couple of his phrases have always stuck with me. One is that sundry stuff, the mechanics, the fundamentals that you just, you know, it has to be migrated to the back of your mind. And that's kind of struck a chord with me just because so many people ask me technical questions. And I'm like, yeah, here's how you do it. Boom, 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 boom. Get that done, memorize it. Boom, make it done, make it rote. You know, you shouldn't even have to think about that. Here's the answer, remember it. Kind of thing. And then the other thing he says that stuck with me is, one, and I'm going to paraphrase it and probably butcher it here, but he said during this Google talk that, you know, he'll wake up in the morning and look in the mirror and he'll go, I'm such a loser. What am I doing? You know, everyone has that feeling. And when he said that, I had to laugh out loud. I'm like, that's hysterical. I don't know anyone that's not felt that way at some point in time. And people have confided in me with that. Dude, you're not alone. I've been there too. I'll feel that way tomorrow probably. You know, there's nothing wrong in feeling, you know, hesitant about that. But like David said, that's when it's most crucial to share your work, to get that connection going with others, to kind of help re-energize you. That, you know, I think that's a critical part of feeding off of the energy of others. You know, when you're down and you're hesitant about things, share your thoughts, share your images, share these, ideas with others, because if you're feeling down and out, obviously someone out there is going to be like, no, wait, man, look at this. Look what was so fantastic about this. Get that out there. Share it with others. And you can kind of feed off each other. And then when someone else is down, you'll be high energy, and you can, you know, feed them some positive energy and get them back up and going again. It's that whole dialogue that is never ending between people when you network. So, yeah, that's awesome. David, did you share a couple of your I'm sorry, go ahead.
I was just going to say, while we're still on that topic, what I've said to some is, it's really about telling the truth of who you are in your images. And if that means that you're not quite sure of an image, that's still telling the truth. You know, it becomes a bit of a lie when you just do things for what you want them to be or what you want people to think. It's much more honest to say, this is me. You go through my website, a lot of people say, geez, Dave, that's pretty dark stuff. You know, what's with the crosses and the dark tones and subjects that are, you know, dead, like a lot of the bones I use in my images. Well, that's me. I'm a Scorpio. I can be a dark star sometimes, you know?
Are you really a Scorpio? I'm a Libra. That's so funny. I'm right on the cusp, too. That's so wild.
Yeah.
So just to kind of wrap things up, the last bullet point that we kind of had for the podcast here, and I want to thank David, first off, before I forget, for taking so much out of his day today, because we had about 10, 20 minutes of glitches there that were all my fault. David was very patient and waiting for me to get those issues resolved. So first and foremost, thank you very much for your patience and waiting for me to get these software issues addressed and network issues addressed. But the last thing to talk about as we wrap up the show is to share some possible, I don't know if you have any thoughts off the top of your head here, but hopefully share some possible ways that we can help others to promote and market and advertise and get their work out there, because it doesn't just, it does, in my mind anyway, it doesn't end when you go to Twitter and say, here's a picture I took of dinner. You know, that doesn't count as marketing. That doesn't count as marketing and advertising and promotion. It's like saying, okay, here's a body of work, here's a gallery of images that have a, you know, express a certain vision, and then promoting that body and doing so in a way that others can appreciate. Because let's face it, a twit pic isn't going to do it in most instances.
Mm-hmm.
So, David, did you have any thoughts you wanted to share?
Pic, I like that.
Yeah, twit pic.
Yes, I do. I do. I spend a great deal of time thinking, why haven't I put these images up yet? Why? What am I going to do with these? How am I going to market these? I think this voice is very common, and those who say they never have it are probably lying. Sorry, but it's true. I really believe that there's a difference. There is marketing images and there is sharing images. And I think it's inherently different. A website that's a personal piece, like a Flickr website or a Picasa website or any website, is a great place to share your images. But if you do just that, you may not get any feedback from anybody. So blogging's fantastic. Everyone can set up a blog now for pretty much free, right? WordPress or otherwise.
Sure.
When it comes to really marketing, there's something that you know very well, Jason, about the power of social media. And what makes social media a kind of a bailiwick is that it seems so random and so gigantic and overwhelming. What do you do? How do you do it? How is it all about numbers? Is it all about hits? Some may say so. Some of the experts tell you that it's all about that. Well, that's fine if your purpose is to get exposure by hits. But if you really want to turn your hobby or your craft or your passion for photography into something that could earn you, you've got to identify who it is that might buy your images. And that's marketing, not even 101, I think it's 0.5. And that is, you can't sell things randomly. You've got to have an idea of who to aim them at, especially in today's world. Especially right. In today's world. And there are lots of ways of doing that. A friend, one of my students, I love this guy, Ryan. All the pictures that he brought in during our 3-week class were all about one thing. And it became kind of a class joke. It's okay, we're going to do a crit now. What do you think Ryan's going to bring? More baseball. Well, it's his passion. He is so impassioned with baseball that he just wanted to create a career around that. Photography and baseball. Not a bad idea. It's a specialty. It's very marketable. It's very researchable. And now he photographs sports for the Huffington Post and for a couple of the university teams. And he's totally following his passion. He's willing to get paid poorly at first in order to develop a large portfolio of really good images. And I love that. That's totally honest. So in his case, it's a little bit more focused and a little easier. If you're a general shooter, or if you're as multifaceted or tentacled as I am, I guess I could be a quadrophrenic octopus, basically, with the way I am. It's a lot to market. It's a lot to think about.
Would you say a quadrophrenic octopus?
Don't think about that too much.
That's a funny phrase. I've never heard of a quadra octo. I'm like, that's the logic in me saying 4 times 8 is what, 32?
it's all either that or one brain for every two tentacles. Anyway, my point is that if you're a generalist, you can share your images, but if you want to take it past that, if you want to take this into something that's remunerating, then you really do want to spend some time isolating groups of images that appeal to specific markets and do internet research, especially on Google, to see who's buying those images. Going to existing stock agency websites, looking at images that are of the same subject you're passionate about, and seeing what the keywords are tells you a lot about how to use the images and who might be buying them.
And also,
lots of little underground tricks.
Right, exactly. Yeah, you hit the nail on the head there.
I'm sorry, I lost you.
Yeah, I'm hearing a little bit of feedback on both ends. So I would actually just wholeheartedly agree with that on the on looking at stock agency sites. Sometimes I'll actually do that. I'll go on iStock, and I'll just search for hot items. You know, what's hot right now? You know, if I'm struggling to find a creative voice or find a creative path to go down, I'll just search that. It's just like looking at photo books in a library, right? There's nothing wrong with that, with finding inspiration from others. There's absolutely nothing wrong with that.
Well, so finding what it is to concentrate on because it's marketable, and that can be good if it's something that you align yourself with. If you're banging yourself over the head to become a race car photographer, but you really love people, listen to that.
Yeah, you got to hear that voice too. Absolutely. Yeah. The one thing I've told people often is if they're trying to find these outlets and ways to go through social media or marketing or advertising, if you don't have an iPad, there's nothing wrong with not having an iPad. You can actually have physical prints. Believe it or not, people still will look at physical prints of pictures. Now, yeah, it's cool and flashy to have that iPad, so if you wanted to go into your local coffee shop and say, hey, I've got a portfolio of images, I'd love to hang a few on your wall for free. You know, take a look at some of these, tell me what you think would fit in here. You can be flipping through an iPad, or you can be thumbing through a portfolio with the manager of the coffee shop. And mm-hmm. like, oh, I'll take that.
That's all legitimate.
Hey. Yeah, there's great. There's nothing wrong in doing that. Doing it
I
that
love
way.
Having... Yeah, yeah. I don't travel without a physical portfolio, but I'm not talking about the big heavy things like the old days. But I do take a series of prints in a little 8.5 by 11, pretty much indestructible binder, or a blurb book, you know, a book produced by one of these on-demand printing. Great way of just taking some images, and it kind of says this is a finished image. This is a product. This is tangible, versus just internet things, which people are used to spending a quarter second on and right. may not actually speak to, oh, here's what this image really could be. And to take it up a notch, positioning your image into the magazine cover of the magazine you'd really like to work for is a great way of saying, look, here's how my images could fit. Here's a little layout that I did or had done to show how my images could work with pictures.
Oh, my God, that's awesome. I love that. What a great idea. Put your image inside the magazine you want to be published in. See how – that's brilliant. That's brilliant, David.
Yeah. You don't want to tell the art director that you know how to design better than I do because
– Yeah, don't do that. Yeah. Well, you just said that, though. I just went, duh, why hadn't I thought of that before? So, yeah, that's – what a great idea. Well, again, Dave, hey, listen, thank you for taking so much time out of your day. We are at the hour and 10-minute mark here of the podcast, so I'm going to go ahead and thank the viewers for tuning in to listen to the podcast. For those of you that have tuned in and listened for the whole hour, you can find out more about David Julian over on his website. His website can be found at davidjulian.com. I'll spell that whole thing out for you. It's D-A-V-I-D. JULIAN.com. I'll throw a link to it in the show notes. And David, you're also on Twitter. I believe your handle is. What is your handle on Twitter again? I just had
David
it up
Julian,
there.
David Julian. My Twitter handle is David Julian Arts, ARTS.
Yep. And what about other social media?
And I'm not real active. Well, I'm not a social media maven yet, but I am on Twitter, I'm on G+, and I'm on Google+, and of course Facebook. I have a Facebook site. If you look up David Julian, it says David Julian Illustration, Photography, and Teaching, and that place where I really encourage people to visit me. I'm very accessible. I do respond to people. I invite people to learn about my life through my presence on the net, and my blog. My blog is in its infancy, but it's davidjulian.com/blog. Couldn't be easier to remember.
Couldn't be easier.
So join me there, subscribe to it. Yeah, and I'm really going to start populating it heavily with tips and tricks and stories about how I shot things. But, yeah, check that out, and if it's as good as Jason's blog, I'd be happy someday.
Geez, oh, peace. Don't even go
Thank
there.
Thank you.
Don't even go there, but yeah. Well, thank you for the time. And if you wanted to also take a quick moment, you had mentioned doing your photography workshops and the training sessions. How would people find out more about that kind of stuff?
Oh yeah. My blog has a tab that's about workshops, and my website also has a tab for workshops that leads you to the blog. That's where I post upcoming workshops. I also do a lot of private teaching. I do that online via Skype, or I meet people in different towns as I travel and we schedule things. I love doing that. I love working one-on-one. So if you want to learn from me through Skype or try a different specific technique or workflow, that's a great way to get a hold of me. And to do that, best way is to go to my website and send me a note, an email.
Awesome. Well, hey, David,
can I give out an email address? Is that cool?
Yeah, it's entirely up to you.
Okay, I'll do it. It's art, that's A-R-T, at davidjulian.com.
So do you want that to be a link in the show notes?
I don't know if that's a good idea because of the way, if you can mask it by doing a parentheses dot or parentheses at, then it won't get, captured by the bots.
Right.
Right. Yeah, then yeah, that's I shouldn't have said a link in the show notes. Do you want me to populate the show notes with your email address? So it was a foregone conclusion that I wouldn't make it something clickable, so sorry about that.
Okay.
No bots allowed.
Thanks, Jason.
No bots allowed.
Apologies there to David Julian. We got cut off as we were starting to get a little bit of lag there at the end of the podcast. So just wanted to say thanks again to David for taking the time out to participate in the Learning Digital Photography podcast. Thank you to everyone for tuning in, and we'll catch you next time here at canonblogger.com, home of the Learning Digital Photography podcast. Take care, everyone. Bye.